All right. Welcome, everyone, and good evening. I don't think we have anybody from Australia here for whom it would be the next day. So I think we're all experiencing an evening.
Land of good evening.
I will go around and say hi, starting with Jinryu and John, Erica, Bob K. Dave, Ellen, who I, it always makes Shoketsu go like this because that's her name. Susan, Tyler, Aaron, Joan, Jeff, Shoketsu, Marv, Drew, Franklin, Gathel, Yashitsoki, and Sabrina. All right. Welcome, everyone. Let's see. In terms of announcements, I can't think of too much except to just update you. I decided on an actual metric for deciding when we go back to the Zendo. So, it will be in the newsletter and it's on the website, but so that I, you know, so it's not just like a constant guessing game. So I decided to tie it to the, so the New York Times has, they aggregate information. And they have risk levels assigned to like every state and every county in every state. So you can actually go to their website and you can, you know, drill all the way down to Washington County in Oregon, which is where we are, and see what the risk level. I'm not sure exactly how they calculate it, but I'm assuming it's a congregation of, you know, cases and hospitalizations and ICU capacity and all that stuff. So, anyway, right now we are at very high risk. There's extreme risk. We're not at that, but very high. There's high. And then when it goes down to moderate, so when it goes down to moderate, we will go into the Zendo with fully vaccinated, 10 people, socially distanced, blah, blah, blah. So you can keep your eye on that. See if we're going down in that direction. Seems reasonable to go back when there is moderate risk as opposed to high risk, but not necessarily wait until low risk, because who knows when the heck that's ever going to happen. Marv.
Thanks. I just wanted to make an announcement. Also, this is about the Zen Studies podcast discussion group that meets on Thursday afternoons at 5 p.m. Pacific time in the Bright Way Zen Zoom room. Just wanted to let you know we have in-depth and frank discussions on the relevance of Dobyo's teachings to our particular lives and practice. At a recent meeting, Ruth Ann thought maybe more Sangha members might want to attend if they knew which episode would be discussed each week. So I would like to be making regular announcements. And for this Thursday, it will be episode 180, The Dharma of Staying Calm When Facing Challenges. Thanks.
Thank you. Tyler.
Would that maybe be able to, I don't know who organized it, be added to the newsletter just in case we miss a Tuesday or something? I don't know if this is an ongoing thing, or is it sort of separate from Bright Way Zen, I guess?
No, it's in the, I think it is announced in the newsletter. Is it, Marv?
I must have just missed it.
But in which case, is it in the newsletter? Do you know, Marv?
The particular episode, no.
Well, that's something that, if you email me at info@brightwayzen, I can hook you up with Lisa, who puts together our newsletter. And that's something that you could send to her, and then it could be in the newsletter.
It's definitely on the website. Right there, well, on the front page.
But the episode is not. So the idea is he could tell her what the episode is and she can stick it in the newsletter each week. All right, okay. Cool.
Thank you.
I'll do that. Other announcements? Joan.
Yes, I just wanted to say a few words about our financial fundraising campaign, Bright Way Forward. By now, everyone should have received a letter explaining what the campaign is about. And if you have not already been contacted by a board member or a former board member, that should be happening soon. And they're going to, you know, want to talk to you about donating, but also about what is important to you at Bright Way. The dates for the campaign are, well, it lasts about a month. It started on September 22nd, and it'll end October 20th. The goal is to raise $5,000. So please give some thought to whether or not you can contribute, either by increasing up your monthly pledge or a one-time donation. And know that whatever you decide, we appreciate you and your participation. Mm-hmm. And so thank you in advance.
Thank you. And I should clarify, I'm looking around. So if you are a member, you will have gotten a letter and be anticipating a call. If you are not yet a member, then you wouldn't be on that list yet. But you could certainly, there's on the front page of the website, there's a button and information about this. Plus, there's information about joining as a member if you are curious about doing that on the website. Because that's another way to support. So that's where we get most of our support, is just regular membership stuff. All right. Any last questions or comments? All right. Tonight, we are continuing with our Nine Fields of Zen practice series. And this is class 4 on the third of the nine fields on cultivating insight. And so I'm not sure, I think everybody here has been to one of these classes already, but just very briefly, just in case. An intro to, you know, what the nine fields are. If some great generous soul could look it up on the Zen Studies podcast website and drop in a link, that would be great. I don't have that prepared. So the nine fields is something I created to try to describe the breadth and variety of Zen practice. So what I most wanted to do was make it clear that Zen practice can permeate every aspect of your life, and it can take many different forms. So, you know, beyond simply Zazen, beyond simply, you know, attending Sangha, things like this, beyond necessarily reading. So there's quite a number of different fields, including precept study and karma work and opening the heart. And so far, we have discussed Zazen, which is pretty central to our practice. And there's recordings of the classes available on the Bright Way Zen website under resources, audio, classes. So if you missed any, you can go back and listen. And so we talked to, because the aim is for this particular series to be very practical. And I'm hoping there will be lots of questions, and no question is stupid or too simple or basic or anything. You know, if it's just, how do I find time to sit Zazen, might be a question, right? So we've covered Zazen and Dharma study, which is, you know, studying the teachings. And this week is cultivating insight, knowing for ourselves. So this is working on a personal, direct, experiential insight into the deeper truths that the teachings are trying to convey. So in Dharma study, I call that exposing ourselves to the teachings. so we can't possibly study all the Buddhist teachings that there are, but we just, you know, what's recommended is just to expose yourself to them and not necessarily worry about understanding all of it. But it's the kind of thing like when you are in, you know, college or graduate school and, you know, if all this information is coming at you and you can't possibly actually like remember it all, but at least you become familiar with what is out there and then you know what to go look for perhaps at a certain time. So now we're talking about how to work on that personal direct insight into some of these teachings. And so tonight I'm going to, this will have three sections to it, and I'm going to stop at the end of each section and invite questions. So, you know, as you're going, if a question, you know, appears in your mind, just, you know, jot it down, or if it really seems abrupt, just go ahead and raise your hand. I'm, you know, I don't just want to be a talking head. I would love for there to be lots of interaction and to make this really relevant. So the three sections, I said them. So the first being the meaning and importance of insight in Buddhism. Why did I include this as a field? Why is this important? And what do we really mean by insight? And the second part being, what is it that we want to awaken to? What is it we want insight about? And you'll be happy to know that that isn't an infinitely long list of things. There's several really key things. And then third, how do we cultivate insight? How do we actually practice in this field? So the first, the meaning and importance of insight. As many of you know, the Buddhism started with insight. So Siddhartha went on a quest, a spiritual journey, and he practiced for many years, and that culminated in his awakening. And a Buddha is an awakened being. It means an awakened being. So thereafter, he was called a Buddha because he experienced, sometimes we call it enlightenment or awakening. So he had wondered about human suffering, and are we basically just victims of the winds of fate? That sometimes things are wonderful and isn't that great, but then eventually we face old age, disease, and death and loss, and you know, then things just suck, and that's nothing to be done about that. That all seemed not quite right to him, so he went on a quest for many years, and then let's say he had an aha. So this aha kind of experience is central in Buddhism. He saw. So language is limiting. He saw, he understood, he perceived how human beings could free themselves from suffering. So he saw the answer to his question he arrived at. And in his first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, Setting the Wheel of Dhamma in Motion, he describes to his first audience, his, not in great detail, but he talks about awakening to these truths, the Four Noble Truths. So he says, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of stress or dukkha. This is the noble truth of the origin of stress, which is to be abandoned. This is the noble truth of the cessation of stress. This is the way of the practice leading to the cessation of stress. So those are the four noble truths. So he has this insight arise. But furthermore, he also, as each one comes up, he says, so the insight arose, and this noble truth of stress is to be comprehended. and then realizing this noble truth of stress has been comprehended. So there's these subtle different levels of experience. So first of all, he kind of sees it, then he understands this has to be completely comprehended and digested. And then he realizes, yes, he has completely comprehended and digested this. And the noble truth of the origin of stress, and this the origin needs to be abandoned. And then he realizes the origin of stress has been abandoned. So he doesn't just have insight, he acts according to what he has seen. The noble truth of cessation of stress has been directly experienced. And this noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress has been developed. So that's what he described. And he said, only then did he say, yeah, okay, I got it. You know, now I can go teach it. So the Buddha's awakening freed him from suffering and stress. So even if you don't believe in some kind of permanent enlightenment state, which I'm rather agnostic about myself, but even if he experienced suffering and stress again, he had the understanding and practice to allow him to free himself again. So did this aha happen in one night, the way the story goes? Maybe, maybe not. But in our own experience, we all have had ahas, and sometimes they are small and they're kind of incremental, and sometimes they're quite consequential and dramatic. So there's two take-home lessons about insight that I want to get across. So this isn't exactly how Buddhism would put it, but this is how I'm putting it. The truth sets you free. So that's a pretty core aspect of Buddhism. The truth sets you free. If we see reality clearly, we will turn away from suffering naturally. Beings want to be happy and avoid suffering. It's just like not wanting to touch a hot stove, right? If we see reality clearly, like things will take care of themselves in a way. And we don't need to, so this is different from the idea that we need to cultivate or work ourselves into some kind of special rarefied state, that we need to work out like we're athletes, spiritual athletes, and, you know, get all toned up, have an immense amount of strength or something like that, some kind of special condition that allows us to be free from suffering. That's not what this is. This is saying, just see reality. It's not something special we create or maintain. It's just be in contact with reality. And the take-home lesson two is there are different degrees of knowing for yourself. So if cultivating insight is knowing for yourself, and we're going to get in a moment to like what it is you want to focus on knowing for yourself, there are different degrees of knowing for yourself. So some of you will have heard me use this analogy before, where, you know, you can have different degrees of knowledge of New York City. You know, you may find out, you may read about New York City and think, wow, what an amazing place. And it can be inspiring, and you can have some knowledge about it, about its history and, you know, how it's laid out, how it's governed. And, you know, you can see pictures of it, stuff like that. So you have some knowledge of New York, and it may make a difference to your life. Now, if you get to make a trip to New York, now you have a different, you know, level of knowledge. Maybe you get to stay there for a week and travel around and, you know, see the sights and smell the smells and ride the subway and, you know, all of that. And it's like, it's very different kind of knowledge. And that's, you know, you might say it's deeper. It's, you know, all what you knew before, but now you've really enriched it. And of course, now maybe you actually go live there for a while. Now you're going to have a much deeper understanding of New York. And then, you know, somebody who's lived there all their life is going to have a different kind of relationship to that. So it's not a matter when we talk about these things that, you know, a teaching, that it's an all or nothing thing, you know, that John has, yep, he knows. Erica, she doesn't know. I mean, it's, that's not, doesn't, not how it works, right? There's degrees of knowledge. There's intuitions we have. There's small insights we have, bigger ones, understanding that just grows over time. So anyway, that's the other take-home message. The truth sets you free, and there are different degrees of knowing for yourself. So I'll pause there to just open it up to questions about, if any, about what we mean by awakening in Buddhism, or why it's important, or any ideas or questions or misconceptions or whatever that you have about that idea.
So Ellen, I have one question. I always wonder about the idea of revelation, like a sudden kind of bolt of lightning revelation, as like, is that a more true form of enlightenment than something that happens gradually over time? Mm. I can say for myself, I have never once had a clear moment of epiphany, whatever you want to call it. So in your mind or in the teachings, do you think that type of quick explosive event has more of a profound effect on somebody or not?
That is a great question. Thank you for asking. So, you know, not all Buddhist teachers, I imagine, would give the same answer to that. But what my experience has been, and what my teachers taught me, and my teachers, they come from a lineage where we don't emphasize, you know, dramatic awakening experiences as something you're aiming for, but we also don't deny that they happen sometimes to people. And so, you know, both of those things were there. And, but my teachers held that, first of all, most of us, we don't get to decide how our path is going to unfold. It seems very unpredictable. Some people might try really hard and they never have a dramatic experience. And some people, the dramatic experience just comes up and bites them on the butt. It just, who knows why. And Kyogen, actually, he had a dramatic awakening experience, and Kyokuko, my teacher, did not. And I have not, although I think it's all relative, right? And the way that, I mean, he even speculated that sometimes people who have dramatic experiences actually have, not to point blame or anything, but just like they have some trauma, actually. They can sometimes, it's something in their mind is very brittle or suppressed or something. And then the shift is very, very dramatic. Whereas I felt like my mind, bless my parents and my fortunate upbringing, my mind is very, very resilient. So my mind goes like, whoa, that's enough. That's a lot to absorb there. That's all we're going to look at right now. So it kind of felt like just, you know, I just get these little intuitions, these little glimpses, but ultimately, and this is what my teachers encouraged, like we get to the same place, whether So my Kyogen described it as like some lotus blossoms go like this, and some lotus blossoms just open up a petal at a time. And even more so that even after years of practice, sometimes it's like walking in a mist. You end up wet, but you don't necessarily notice this process. So I've developed a lot of faith. Like, I really wanted to have some big dramatic awakening experience. And at some point, you know, after years and years, I was like, why do I want that? And I recognized it was because I wanted to be free from doubt. I wanted to be able to say, look, look, there it happened. Look, you know, like, I know for sure because I fell off my chair one day. But then I recognized after all the years of practice and all the little moments of insight that I didn't have doubt anymore. So, you know, what's the difference? So in a way, those dramatic experiences, they're different. If we don't have one, we don't really know what they're like, and they can make a... Actually, they tend, frankly, to cause a lot of disruption in people's lives. It takes a lot to integrate them, and sometimes they really turn people's lives upside down. So frankly, it's not something to envy necessarily. So Dave.
So in listening to the material for this, I was kind of forced to think about my own experience up to this point. And it occurred to me that I've never really for a moment considered that I might myself one day become awakened. And I think that might be something that drew me to this practice in particular, because I can get my head around Shiken Taza. Like sitting on a cushion, I got, but trying to beat my head against a koan until something shakes loose seems a little bit, you know, that's not really my jam. So, I mean, is it important at all that we have that sort of idea that we want to become awakened beings? And if not, is that particular to Soto Zen? Because I feel like a lot of other traditions are really, really hot on becoming awakened.
Well, I think your question leads perfectly into my second part, which is what do we want to become awakened to? Because, you know, what does that mean? We want to become an awakened person, right? Like, what is that? And, you know, what actually matters? I mean, there is part of me, yeah, I'd love to be like a be like the Dalai Lama and walk around in great peace and equanimity, and everybody would think I was an amazing saintly person. You know, okay, there's a little attraction there, but ultimately, is that really what I care about? So, you know, I think it'll be more clear. So let's return to that. I will talk about what we want to awaken to, because it's, again, it's not a binary thing. So I think if we want to be walking a spiritual path, we want to be moving gradually more and more awakened about these particular things, which are the Four Noble Truths and the true nature of self. So there's many, many other teachings, and that is, they're wonderful, but it's all, after a certain point, you recognize they're all kind of the same teaching, just in different guises. So in a way, all teachings, like, ultimately, when you go in there, you're approaching the same issue, just from a different, in a different, slightly different way. So the essence of this is the nature of suffering and learning how to release ourselves and others from suffering. And the true nature of self, which the self is the stickiest part of our delusion. So I'm gonna go into this. So the Four Noble Truths, which is something that we don't necessarily talk about them a lot in Zen, in that formulation. Like, let's talk about the Four Noble Truths. But this is underlies our practice in many, many different ways. So there's two different ways I can describe this as like the essence. This is the essence of Buddhism to some extent. Your experience of life is largely dependent on the state of your own mind and heart. So if you don't even want to break it down into four noble truths, that's, I feel like that is the essence. Life is marked by, traditionally we say there's eight kinds of suffering. So this is what Siddhartha was wrestling with that sent him on his spiritual quest. And that is birth, which usually we think birth as being, you know, a joyful thing. But if you think about it also as being new beginnings and change, and, you know, that can be uncomfortable. Birth, aging, you don't need to go into any detail there. Aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. That's all kind of one thing. All right, we got that. Association with the unbeloved. So association with what we do not enjoy, we do not like, we do not prefer. Separation from the loved. Not getting what is wanted. So these are the eight different forms that just the suffering in human life takes that we cannot avoid. At some point, we are going to experience these, every one of these things. And yet, what Shakyamuni Buddha awakened to was that despite all of that, we can have peace and strength and ease. So it's not a matter of, well, this sucks, but if you behave in a certain way, you'll be reborn in a place where everything's great. That's not what this is about. And it's not about other kinds of religions and spiritual traditions said that if you do this, this, and this, then you should have good luck. And if you don't have good luck, you know, you're to blame for that in some way. But as if you can just kind of mess around with the details of life enough to prevent experiencing those sufferings. But Buddhism says, yes, those are inevitable part of human life, and yet your experience of that is largely dependent on the state of your own heart and mind. So there is something that we can do with our own heart and mind that means we have some agency, we have some hope, because there's always something that we can do to break free of the suffering that we add. Or another way to put it, the essence of it is, no matter what happens to you, you have choice about how to respond. There is a way. It may not be easy to find or easy to apply or easy to make into a habit, but there is a way, no matter what happens to you, to live in peace and ease with compassion and real happiness. So that's a big promise. So the idea is that exploring the Four Noble Truths, or this truth, if you just want to dissolve it into one essence, exploring this for ourselves, understanding, to being able to recognize the stress, the dukkha that the Four Noble Truths talks about, being able to recognize where it comes from, being able to see it clearly enough that we're inspired to try to give up whatever it is that we're holding on to that's causing the suffering, that is, you know, the essence of our practice. If we don't do that, if we don't take responsibility for ourselves in that way, I don't know, it's probably too extreme to say we're not Buddhists, because there's all different ways to be Buddhist. But I would say that you're not really doing Zen practice if you're not approaching things this way. So any difficulty, constriction, pain, any of that that we encounter, we ask ourselves, what can we let go of here? And fundamentally, it will be about letting go of resistance to what is. So once again, this is about seeing reality and recognizing in what ways essentially we're going, no, we're resisting change, or we're, you know, holding on. We don't want things to be the way that they are, which fundamentally is like, you know, there's those eight sufferings, they come and go, there's impermanence. And it's our resistance to that that causes the worst suffering. So according to Buddhism, it's we can't escape pain in the sense of physical pain, emotional pain, even psychological pain. That's just part of life. If you get sick or you lose a loved one, there will be pain. But we have suffering. Dukkha is optional. Not that we're going to feel some of it as well, right? We're not going to, our practice isn't going to be perfect, but we have some choice in the matter about dukkha, about that stress that we add, where we make ourselves more miserable about it. We're holding on to expectations, or we're wishing things could be different. So I thought about giving you a just kind of a real life example of what I think, trying to cultivate insight, personal knowledge of the Four Noble Truths might look like. So let's say you have a tense and stressful relationship with a partner. Maybe you can translate this into some other relationship if you want. But there's dysfunctional interactions. Let's say you really need your partner to reassure you that they love and care about and respect you. And you need them to say it, and you need them to say it explicitly and often. But this isn't their style, and they start to be resentful of having to reassure you, as if maybe they can't be trusted. So their resistance or withdrawal sets off your insecurity. And then you're even more inclined to make demands or be clingy or jealous or reactive. So, you know, this is an example of one of those just, two people, and the dysfunction just keeps on building. So what can be done? So let's say you set aside your usual thoughts and feelings about the situation long enough to look clearly. So this is our meditation practice. So we do these different practices to allow us to just try to, you know, settle the mind and look at things from a different perspective. What is going on here? And you look beneath the obvious. I want this person to express their love more. Or you look, these are the obvious things. I want this person to express their love more. This person isn't filling my needs. Those are the kind of obvious things that we're usually thinking about. But if we look below that, maybe you notice your own fear. What is this fear? You examine that. What is this? What is this thing that is causing this suffering? What does it feel like? What narrative goes along with it? And you see it's a fear of losing your intimate relationship with this, which is a vital source of support and joy for you. And what is this fear? What triggers this fear? And you notice that it really doesn't have anything to do with what your partner does or doesn't do. You notice it doesn't spring from that. It's very fundamental. Like there's nothing they could do to guarantee that you won't lose them, because that's the nature of life. It's just, we can't hold on to anything. Impermanence is part of the nature of life. So you might notice that you have this fundamental fear, and you're asking your partner to try to you know, remit that fear. But that can't actually happen because this is just the nature of life. And this is kind of scary to face. You ultimately have no control over whether your partner continues to love or care about you. But what can you do about this in the sense of practice? And if you stay with the issue, maybe ask yourself, what would it be like to just let go of the effort to try to prevent loss, to preemptively defend against loss or betrayal? What if you looked at your partner's presence and loyalty as a gift? When you feel gratitude for, even as you're aware there's no guarantee it'll be around forever, even as you're aware it will not be around forever. And then perhaps if this is something that, again, like the Buddha, there was these different levels of understanding, and we might get to a point where there's a shift. There's an actual shift where you go and you're less reactive, a little more filled with gratitude, a little more open-handed. So to me, this is an example of how it can unfold in our lives as we are cultivating insight, personal experience of this core teaching. So I've still got a lot to cover, but I'll pause there for any questions about cultivating personal insight, particularly about the nature of suffering and letting go and the Four Noble Truths. Or comments or anything that you want to share. Jinryu.
I just have a question. I just find that when I've had flashes of insight, it's not been on the mat, on the cushion. Mm-hmm. It's been when I'm trying to be mindful in the kitchen or mindfully doing the laundry. And you're smiling, so that tells me that maybe that's okay.
That tells me that you're just like feeding into my next section beautifully, where I say, you know, shikantaza, which that's a question many people have. It's like, well, if I'm just sitting there and I'm not trying to control anything, and like, well, how does that lead to insight, right? It's not, there is insight meditation, right? There are meditation where you like, you sit down there and you have a subject and you examine it. And that's not what we're doing in shikantaza. So I would say there's other ways that we do that kind of exploration. But shikantaza, I would say, prepares us. It softens us and opens us and prepares us for that insight to happen. Drew.
So I think my question was really what you were just talking about. So yeah, like you open yourself up to this insight, like in the example you're saying, you know, you can see this person as a gift, but there's no guarantee that insight is just going to pop out of nowhere, right? So like, what do we do on top of our Zazen practice to get there?
Uh-huh. Yes, so that will be my third section, how to do this. So I need to kind of hurry on through the other thing that we're supposed to awaken to, which we don't need to spend much time on, which is the emptiness of self. You know, just gloss that one over. So the other thing that, I mean, I don't know, I might wake up tomorrow and think like, oh wait, there's that other thing we're supposed to awaken to. But I think, you know, this is pretty fundamental, just freeing ourselves from suffering and the true nature of self, which is self and all things are empty of. So something is empty of something we expect to be there. So a glass is empty of water, or a house is empty of people. Emptiness means there's something you expect to be there, you assume to be there, that might be there, and it's not there. So empty can sound really negative, but what it's pointing at is that we assume that we and all things, but we care really the most about ourselves, that we have an inherent, enduring, independent self nature. There is something that is me, which has endured through all the changes in my life and is the agent of what I do and what I think and what I experience. And this self is separate from other things. It has relationships with other things, but it's kind of the very definition of self is that it is this, you know, it's an individual. It's separate from other things. And while conventionally speaking, as we go about our daily lives, this is a useful way to think about things, because I have a house, you have a house, I have bills, you have bills. Like, it's good to be able to discriminate those things and take responsibility for ourselves. But what the teaching is not all there is to it. That there's a dimension of reality where, like, we are not separate from anything else. Or the self is boundless. There is no, I am who I am because of so many causes and conditions that came before, that are right now, the sun, gravity, air. I am who I am because of all of you. Doesn't even make sense to talk about me independent of all of this. And so therefore, this self is not a separate enduring entity. It's interdependently co-arisen. So it just arises with everything. And because of impermanence, everything is constantly changing. So even if I have a certain character or flavor right now, that's not something that I can grasp and hold on to. Not something I can point to and keep. So this self, this nature of self, it's empty of this inherent existence that we think it has. And what it really is boundless, and that the experience is not one of nihilism, but of recognizing that all things are yourself. Like, we're all one self. We're alive, we're real, and not separate. So I have very little time to talk about this, but this is an extremely valuable thing to awaken to whatever extent we can awaken to it. So again, it's not a binary thing. It's not a, you know, you're ignorant of it and so-and-so had a great awakening experience and they've got it. It's that degrees of familiarity, and everyone, I have deep faith, everyone has had an intuition of this. Everyone has a glimpse. Everyone has a sense at some point in their lives of this, things are not what they seem, or, you know, moments of kind of perfection and completion, or, you know, who knows when they happened. And like Jinru says, they're rarely, like, you know, when you're deliberately trying to cultivate them, they're watching the steam rise from your teacup. You know, something comes together, becomes clear. And the difficulty of awakening to this in a personal way, as soon as we start to talk about it, we concretize it and it sounds like a really big deal, and that actually gets in our way. So on the other hand, if we don't talk about it at all, then we assume that our current understanding is all there is. So it's a really tricky path that we walk with respect to trying to cultivate deeper insight into this reality. And it isn't easy to awaken to the truth of this but not for the reasons we think. So it's not a matter of, you know, I need to work on my meditation practice really hard, or I need to become a better person, or I need to, you know, all the things that we think of in the usual way of striving to understand something or achieve something. It's more like we are in a play, and you were born in the theater, and that's all you've ever known is just being part of this play and playing your role. And awakening is like looking over and seeing an exit door and walking out into like daylight of a whole, like a world. So it's, we're so caught in our current experience and understanding that it doesn't even occur to us that there might be a completely different way of seeing, a completely, and once we walk out that door, it's like, wait a second, you mean that was all a play? It puts things in a different perspective. The play is still real. Like, you mean I'm still going to go back and maybe do the play, but it's because of that change in perspective. It's very difficult to take yourself so seriously again. It's very difficult to be quite as caught up, quite as, you know, maybe your role in the play, kind of a miserable role. It's difficult to be quite that caught up again when you have, and again, it's not binary. Maybe you just peeked out the door. Who knows? Maybe you just got a glimpse when somebody else went out the door. But there's something, hey, wait a second, I think there's something more going on here. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to reach, taste for ourselves, because of how it, the transformative effect it has on us, because of how it frees us. So in a sense, you can think that the Four Noble Truths, that kind of working on our karma and our suffering and all that, is kind of it's work that we have to do in any case. But this is a little more of like fundamentally shifting that understanding, which has a profound effect. So I will just see if we should talk about how to cultivate insight, right? Or maybe what I should do is just continue this next week. So maybe we'll just chat a little bit about emptiness, and then next week we'll talk about the how. Okay, let's do that. So any questions or comments or observations? John.
Yeah, thank you so much. So I was just thinking, if someone's sort of looking in from the outside at our practice and they're really smart and they're philosophical, they're a neuroscientist, they might say, well, yeah, it's really easy not to believe that I have an independent self or soul, right? Intellectually, it's, you know, it'd be easy to say, no, I don't believe that. But presumably, if we're surrounding that illusion with all these practices, it's aimed at something like more deeply ingrained belief that we have, regardless of whether we consciously believe in a independent self or not. So could you say something about that?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, I mean, you can read about New York, right? And you've learned something. Okay. You know, so you can contemplate, yeah, we read some books and it seems like we don't have any inherent, you know, self the way we think we do. Okay. You know, and that's has some value. But this is so, it's so much a part of who we are. And it's not a bad thing, right? It's not something to be ashamed of, that we have a strong sense of self. It's actually, you know, one of the arguments is that, I actually heard the Dalai Lama say this. And when I heard him say it, I was like, yay, there's hope for me. Because he said, you have to have a strong sense of self to do this practice. like, this is about transcending that sense of self, not destroying that sense of self. Because that's how our brains work. That's how natural selection designed us. We have a sense of, you know, agency and all this, but to see that's not everything. That's not the whole of reality. And when we see that, it's so helpful. So yeah, it's a, and it ends up being very, very personal. And this is why, like, koan work, you know, aims you at certain things. It's not a matter of sitting there and going like, oh, now I see how no beings have self. You know, like you're seeing some grand, it's like me, myself, my subjective experience. And what we do is we don't go, this is something that I learned at when I was studying with Reb Anderson at Tassajara Monastery. One of the ways is you don't go after the true self, right? I'm going to sit here and like imagine what the true self might be like. What we go after is our delusion of a small self. What is this? That is something that we can find. It's within us. So we need to feel and face and become intimate with our delusion of self. What is that? How am I projecting on this? How am I holding on? When does dukkha arises? When I'm holding on to self. So now that's a sign. Now there's some self there. So we're constantly looking at that. And then there's opportunities in life. I mean, like we were talking about earlier, Zazen, these kinds of things prime us for this, but there are opportunities in life for us to really face this. And frankly, they are opportunities which otherwise would be, and still might be, quite scary or painful or difficult when our sense of ourselves is shaken down to the bones. Something shifts, we lose something, our health falls apart, we lose a job, we lose a relationship. It's usually something that self was very tied up in. And then we go, wow, I had that thing that I thought was so solid is, you know, clearly not what I thought it was. And we have an opportunity there instead of just reacting and trying to build the self back up again, to explore that and to say, yeah, yeah, you're not solid the way you think. So it becomes a very, very personal thing. So there's much more that could be said about the emptiness of self, but here we are, 8:59. So, all right, next week we will continue. I'll do a little review, and then we'll talk about the how. So that'll be cool. I will close with our verse. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Daniel.
Great class. Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Bye.
Night.
So I'm just going to leave. I'm not going to end. Bye.
Bye.